Content warning. This podcast contains depictions of and discussions on gender-based violence. Audience discretion is advised.
Over the last six episodes, we have explored many of the issues that feed into the human crisis of gender-based violence in Nova Scotia. In this episode, we want to look forward. How do we build a future free of violence against women? It's simple. We educate our children. Teach them to value themselves and others. Teach them empathy. Eradicate toxicity once and for all.
We're the ambulance at the bottom of the hill. That's what we are. We're picking up the pieces of lives that just have been so wounded and are so in need of help. And all we can do is help them to move from that. We can't break the cycle necessarily at that level. That cycle has to be broken at the young generation. If it's not broken there, it will continue.
I think what worries me the most for our young people in terms of gender-based violence is, in one word, technology. One of the reasons that I think that risk exists is that many of our supports, like formalized supports, system-based supports, they don't keep up. We don't have the capacity to keep up with the ability of the use of technology to perpetuate gender-based violence.
I don't know if parents are monitoring what their children are seeing, if they think they're monitoring, but I have seen children as young as four outsmart their parents around the parental controls of what they're watching. I have seen children watching things that I wouldn't watch.
We often think of it in the context of intimate partner violence, right? Where like one partner is surveying, stalking another partner. But we're increasingly seeing it being normalized where parents are surveying, I would call it borderline stalking their children. Is it okay for parents to always be monitoring where their children are? And I mean, as a parent myself, I understand like the imperative that you want to know where your children are. You want to know that they're safe. But if we're thinking about how that normalizes surveillance, that really worries me.
In Nova Scotia, in Canada, certainly things are different than they were, let's say, 40 or 50 years ago. And in many ways, there have been improvements. And I have often said that we need to look to our youth to lead us, who have been in this work for a long time, because attitudes have begun to shift, have begun to change. When I started in this work over 25 years ago, no one was talking about toxic masculinity. No one was talking about gender diverse people. There was none of that conversation. So the youth can teach us. The gains we've made have driven the risks underground. It can be harder to detect when gender-based violence is at play. Gender-based violence is an epidemic and needs to be treated that way.
Welcome to Somebody Must Say These Things. I'm your host, Ginger McPhee. In this episode, we will be seeking the answer to the question, how can we raise children who don't abuse and build a society that refuses to permit it?
If you want to make change happen, you have to bring people together.
Here's Bryony House's Lori McGinnis.
And you have to use the collective voice to bring what the concern is to the fore so that now it's not just our problem. It's, oh, this is a problem for society, because this is a problem for society. This is a societal problem. Yes, it's families. Yes, it's children. Yes, it's the agencies and support staff, but it's a societal problem.
We're missing the mark. And young people today, they know more.
This is Rhonda Fraser. She's the safety outcome advisor at the Nova Scotia Highest Risk Domestic Violence Table. Before serving in this position, she worked on the front line and at executive levels for almost 3 decades within THANS.
They have more access to information, broader view. I'm going to say again what I've said before and what I truly believe, which is those of us who carry history, those of us who have done this for a long time, we have so much to learn from youth. I also think we need to find a way to not have history repeat itself.
We need to think about how technology is facilitating or enabling sexual violence to kind of happen in many different spheres of life.
This is Dr. Caitlin Mendez, associate professor at Western University's Department of Sociology. She's the Canada Research Chair for Inequality and Gender.
And that's something that a lot of older people really struggle with. They really kind of see like these on and offline spaces as totally separate and distinct. And young people absolutely do not think like that. That's certainly not how they experience the world. It's probably not how really any of us experience the world. But yeah, and we think that it's really harmful to kind of talk about these two spaces as if they were totally separate and distinct. And we really need to kind of bring them together.
If you have a teenager, there's a good chance that you're concerned about the rise of online role models who promote unhealthy relationships and unhinged masculinity.
So a man, when he was a child, if he experienced too much coddling, too much spoiling, too much sappy praise, too much overgiving from either his mother or father, then as a man as he's growing up, will want and crave praise and reassurance and a constant need for someone else to tell him that he belonged.
Society has lied to all of us about our gender roles.
A man who needs to be praised is a man who wants to be mothered. Ladies, stop praising your man.
Life for a man is harder than life for a woman. We need to have a lot of shit to be an important man. To be a woman, you need makeup.
They told women they don't need no man, and they told men to be softer.
Over the last, 30, 40 years, we've really been creative about the way that we think about women and girls. I don't think we've done the same thing for men and boys.
This is Susie Dunn, assistant professor of law at the Dalhousie Schulich School of Law. Her studies focus on the intersections of law and the digital world.
And I think a lot of men and boys are feeling really lost, and they're feeling like they don't have a place in this world. And a lot of this misogynistic, hyper-masculine content is really desirable to them because it gives them a really clear understanding of what's wrong. You know, it says what we need is we need to go back to traditional values. What you need is you need to be physically strong. You need to be financially capable so that you can care for your family. And you need to have a submissive partner. And so a lot of the messaging that comes from folks like Andrew Tate and Jordan Peterson, it's got this very simplistic messaging that I think young men are drawn to in a world where maybe they're not feeling like their place in it is as clear anymore. And also there's not a lot of other options for them to think about masculinity and to think about these things. And so they get drawn into these spaces, I don't think necessarily with a malicious intent, but then as they spend more time on there, the content gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And some of it advocates against sexual autonomy. Some of it advocates for violence against women. And once you start believing in these ideologies and getting deeper and deeper down the rabbit hole, I think that people can get quite contained in that one view of the world. And because of our digital spaces, we can create these tight bubbles where we don't hear a lot of opposing viewpoints. When you hear that repeated messaging, it becomes normalized and it feels every day. And so I do think that there are massive popular communities of people who are making misogyny a part of their everyday world and a part of their everyday language.
How men and young boys define masculinity is often concerning.
Again, Lori from Bryony House.
They're defining it based on all of the wrong concepts. They think that, a man takes a woman. They think that a man, it's his right to be violent, it's his right to express his anger in that way. It's his right to be misogynistic. It's his right to hit his children. It's his right. They think that well, the old term macho, right? The macho man, that's taking me back to the macho man 70s. But anyway, we laugh about it, but it's not really a laughing subject. It's very serious.
We live in an age where hyper-masculinity influencer Andrew Tate was the third most Googled person in 2023. He has built a business preying on the insecurities of young men, teaching them toxic mindsets to fuel pipe dreams of luxurious lifestyles.
You go to a coal mine, those dudes are not down there thinking about oppressing women. They're down there thinking about providing for women. And feminism prevents you respecting it.
And at a time when life is tougher and depression is rife, these figureheads are a symptom of a society that is sick. Professor Dunn had this to say.
All of the data shows that the online harassment and online violence you experience is directly tied to your social identity. So if you're a boy, you're going to get harassed about masculinity. If you're a woman, it's often going to be sex-based. If you're a trans person, it's going to be about gender. If it's about race, it's about race. So I think depending on the social identities of a young person impacts their vulnerability and the type of harassment they're going to have. And then the next thing is, does that young person have a trusted adult in their life who understands technology that they can go to?
One other really interesting thing about social media is what we're hearing from a lot of boys and young men is how the algorithm is playing a really big role in the kind of content they're seeing.
Dr. Mendes had this to say.
And there's been some really, really interesting research coming out of the UK where scholars like Dr. Debbie Ging, she's at Dublin City University in Ireland, and she did a study where she took, you know, some blank phones and registered with like different TikTok accounts. And in some, she didn't give them any information about gender or age, and others that she did. And as soon as she indicated she was like 16 and a boy, they slowly started feeding manosphere content. So they would have like videos with Andrew Tate. And this study, it hasn't been published, it's about to come out, really talks about how quickly boys are inundated with this kind of content. And as soon as you kind of, even if you don't have to like it, but even if you linger on that kind of content for just a little bit too long, your feed suddenly gets filled with this kind of content. So I think we need to do a lot more thinking about the role that algorithms are playing. And right now, like our research team is going around Canada talking to teens. And one of the things we're hearing, particularly from boys, is how their feeds are being filled with this kind of content. And they talk about how these aren't things that they search for, but they increasingly show up. And I think, again, if I think about the role that social media companies play, we really need to pay a lot more attention to their governance. They are not going to release how the algorithms work, but I think we need a lot more attention to the role of algorithms. And this is something I know a lot of parents will say is like, oh, well, I'm on Instagram, like it's all cooking and baking and recipes. And it's like, well, the algorithm feeds you very different things because it knows that that's what you're interested in, but your 15-year-old son is getting fed something totally, totally different.
The National Action Plan to End Gender-Based Violence states that we must address the social and economic determinants that contribute to and perpetuate gender-based violence. It feels like our boys and men are at huge risk of being dragged backwards if we don't.
We do know that we have a problem with young men feeling disconnected.
This is Michelle Corbett. She's a woman's counselor at the Halifax Transition House Association and their shelter, Bryony House.
And maybe the disconnection started with being pretty much plugged into video games and devices. And there are people on the internet that are educating them or, you know, disinformation, a lot of misogyny, kind of the shadow side of the positive things. And our clients reflect that back to us, that some of their partners are engaging or picking up this extreme misogyny that is out there and political beliefs, and it's sort of feeding into the abuse.
As Nelson Mandela said, quote, education is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world. Again, Brenda from Chrysalis House.
One of our children's outreach worker was trained in the Roots of Empathy program. I think that program is amazing. It goes into the schools at a young age, and a mom and a baby are involved in it who volunteer, and it teaches the young children to see babies as people. And I think that's really important, where we get away from this objectifying and this sense that that only happens to other people, where you take young children and you put them in this place where they learn babies have needs, that there needs to be sacrifice for that. The whole part is to create that and develop that sense of empathy. And I think without empathy, we're lost. We have to have that.
Well, systemically, one of the improvements we've seen is domestic violence leave is now something that we have that we didn't have when I first started 6 years ago. It's fairly new.
Here's Briny House's Michelle Corbett.
I remember talking to a McDonald's manager about it to educate them about what it was. A lot of people aren't aware of it. That is a good systemic development. I do believe the education system, I believe it has improved since when I went to going to school in the 80s, we didn't talk about healthy relationships in our health class at all. We did not discuss that. That wasn't part of, say, we would have sex education. Relationships weren't even discussed. It was just simply mechanics and here are the risks and that's it. And there's education on social media now, like even if it's not 100%, there's a lot of talk about red flags and unhealthy relationships, and it starts a lot of conversation.
Well, the first thing that I think is so important to say is that parents need to develop trusting relationships with their children.
Once again, Professor Susie Dunn.
I'm on a research project called DIY Digital Safety, and we've done focus groups with 150 young people across Canada. And one of the big messages that we've been hearing is that often people won't talk to their parents because they're fearful of their parents overreacting, not understanding the value of social media and digital technologies in their social lives, and that they're going to get those technologies taken away or blamed for seeing things or blamed for engaging sexually online. And so I think the first thing parents need to do is they need to develop trusting relationships with their children and having frank, non-blaming conversations with them. But on the flip side of that, there is a lot of problematic content online that parents need to be talking to their children about. There's a unquestionable normalization of non-consensual intimate image sharing. With young boys, they're seeing a lot of gore content, extreme violence, and they're also being inundated with pressures to engage sexually with porn bots, with other types of sexualized content in a way that makes them feel uncomfortable and that they don't want it. So I think we need to be having conversations about that more extreme content that they're having, while also recognizing it's very normal for young people to be socializing online, flirting online, dating online, talking to friends online. That's a normal and healthy part of being a young person. I think it can go both ways. I think some people have underemphasized it. They don't really pay attention to what their kids are doing online, and they just let them do anything. And then there's some parents who think that if you're on the internet, all it's going to be is adult predators and, you know, horrible things that exist out there. So I think that parents, because they're raising a generation of children who are having a fundamentally different childhood than they're having, they have a difficulty understanding it. And I think the real emphasis, again, is learning to have trusting conversations with children and looking to websites like Media Smarts that's actively done research on youth experiences online and have wonderful guides for parents on how to have conversations. I'd also say the same thing for the YWCA Project Shift. There's resources out there that parents who are feeling unsure about what's happening on the internet to go to those spaces to learn how to talk to their young people.
For the women who are on the front line, education begins with the children who are also victims. Rhonda Fraser had this to say.
So people will also often talk about how difficult it is for children to be at the shelter. And you know, disrupted, leaving their homes, middle of the night, Is it a safe environment? We hear that sometimes, this communal living and, is it ideal? I used to say, I don't want anybody to think that women and children who come to the shelter, they're not going on vacation. Believe me, that's not what's happening here. But I was a relief worker at the time, so early days of my career. And there was a family who came in, it might have been like December 22nd, 23rd, they came. So on Christmas Eve, Santa came to the shelter. So he always came, him, and usually he had an elf with him, and he would visit with the women and the children. So this one little guy would not come out. He would not come out of his room. So I went in and I said, why don't you come over into the living room? Santa's there. He didn't care. He didn't care if Santa was there. Didn't make any difference. So I said, just come on over with me. I said, there's a lot of people in the room and it would, come over with me. Hold my hand, come into the living room and let's just have a look and see what's happening. And the little boy walked into the living room and looked at the person who was there as Santa. And this little guy was tough, believe me. He'd only been there for a few days, but he was tough. And he started to cry. And he said, "You're real. There's Christmas. There's going to be Christmas this year." Now, I had my own kids at home when I was working that Christmas Eve. And from that point forward, I would say my children, great family, loved, supported, tons of places to be Christmas Eve with people who love them. I never complained about working Christmas Eve. Never. And that little boy, and my gosh, he's a well-grown man now. I have no idea where he is, but in so many ways, he set the stage for what is now almost a 28-year career for me, because he is in my head every single day. Every single day that I do this work. And I think it is particularly impactful for me that it was a little boy, because back then, now you talk about attitudes and have attitudes changed. I have had folks say to me, not so much now, but back in the day, "Well, I don't know that that's a great place for little boys to be, because the women who work in shelters hate men. The women who go to shelters hate men." And nothing could be further from the truth. Everyone needs to be safe, and everyone needs to have a chance. And those little boys just stick with me.
The National Action Plan to End Gender-Based Violence states that we must recognize the role of men and boys in preventing and addressing gender-based violence. So, how do we fix all of this? THANS and its partner organizations are the ones taking action.
With very few exceptions, children thrive in our transition house. We have a dedicated child care team. They're trauma-informed. There's structured play where kids can explore the feelings that they have because their lives have been completely disrupted, or they've lived in an atmosphere where there's so much tension, they can't play freely. If they show emotions, maybe the mom will get, disciplined, and themselves. So it's wonderful to see children be able to just exhale and be kids again.
We see that actual transformation. Yes. We see children come in, kind of coiled up and shoulders. And then within days, we just see this blossoming of the personality, of being a child. As I gave you that stat earlier, that the average woman leaves her abuser 7 times before she leaves for good, if at all. So if a child comes to us with his or her mother, and then that mother
returns or reunites. Now, she's probably going to be involved with child protection at that point, and they'll have requirements for her to be able to reunite. But if the mother goes back to the abusive situation, or if she doesn't go back to that situation but gets involved in another abusive situation, then the chances are less likely that that child is going to be able to break that cycle.
Here's Rhonda Fraser.
I remember a tradesperson coming to the shelter where I was working at the time. It was a weekend. It was kind of an emergency situation. And I was deep in the throes of, oh, gosh, you know, how much is this going to cost? Is the budget going to support this? But it has to happen. And so the crisis was averted. And the tradesperson and I were having a conversation. It was a fairly young man. I'm guessing he was in his 20s. And he said to me, he said, Rhonda, you don't know who I am. And I said, no, I'm sorry, I don't. And he said, I was here with my mom when I was, I think he said 5 or 6 years old. And he said, you were working when we came here. And he said, I cannot say enough about the difference coming here made to me and to my mom. So he said, anytime our business gets called to come and do work here, I always ask that I'm the one that's sent because I feel that it's a way for me to give back. That story sticks with me.
Yes, there are men that are struggling and are, you know, they're not able to have healthy relationships at this time.
Again, Michelle from Briony House.
But I do have hope that there'll be an expansion of resources to treat those men. Like locally, we have Project New Start, which is a program that treats abusers. So sometimes when, you know, partners might get referred to anger management by child welfare or to community mental health or EAP, but programs that just sort of wrap around the individual and address the abuse. So it's not just, oh, I have an anger problem or I have a mental health issue or an addiction problem. And we talked recently about how sometimes people equate that with, well, that's what caused the abuse, including our women. They feel really bad. They'll say, my partner had a really traumatic childhood and then he got into drugs and alcohol and I feel so bad and that's why he's abusing. So it's wonderful to have that compassion, but we often end up saying, well, there are people that have had traumatic childhoods who are not and who are not doing that. But I think, I do think we owe those who are abusing, I don't think they're happy individuals, like proper support, treatment, role models.
The schools are a really important place to start having these kinds of conversations. And there are some really great examples when it comes to sex ed.
Again, here's Dr. Mendez.
Of places like the Netherlands, where, like, you know, young people are talked about it in school and then they're encouraged to go home and talk about it with their family. So maybe you're kind of given worksheets like, here's some things that I need to chat with you about it, mom and dad. But again, you have to have the right people doing the education. So I think if you have, you know, educators who are really coming in with like the fear-mongering approach, which is like, don't ever take a nude. Only an idiot will do that. It's out there forever. Your life is over. That is actually doing more harm than good. My view is that we really need child rights perspective. We need to be educating young people about their rights. We need to be talking about what positive relationships look like, what digital citizenship looks like, making sure young people know what happens if things go wrong, what can they do? So how to be like a bystander. So if you see something going wrong, are there things that you can do to support the person or help like report something? And we do also, we're in this really interesting moment where there's a clash between the parents' rights and child's rights. And I think it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out. Again, the parents' rights perspective is this idea that parents are the ones, the only ones who should be talking about these sorts of issues with their children. Child's rights perspective says that actually young people have a right to kind of have this information. They have a right to things like privacy. So we're really in this moment where we're seeing a big clash. Places like Alberta, I think we see the parents' rights gaining force, and other provinces as well. There have been some big pushbacks in like Manitoba as well, even in Ontario here where I'm based, probably all across Canada. So that will be an interesting one to watch and see how it plays out.
And I think if we're going to go back to young people, that's the piece that I don't see changing.
Again, here's Rhonda.
That's the piece when I look at social media, when I listen to young people talk, I don't see enough of not only, I'm going to say, calling out the behavior, but once we get to that point where it's normalized to say, nope, not cool, we then need to get to the point of saying, yeah, my bad. I'm accepting responsibility. That is really where we need to be. Because if folks are struggling and the response to the struggle is the use of violence against another human being, we don't know what that person needs. We can make an educated guess, right? We can use our professional judgment. But maybe what that person needs is something that's not system-centered. It's something that's community-centered and relationship-centered. So, and I know I'm talking about utopia, but I think all of us who do this work, we're working for the utopia. We're working for the violence-free communities. That's what our end game is. That's what keeps us going.
Here's Bryony House's Lori McGinnis.
One of the things that really needs funding, and I hope that we will get it, and all the other transition houses, is money for education, money for resources, you know, pamphlets, books, cards that we can put into doctors' offices, universities, dentist's office, wherever people go, and it's safe for them to pick something like that up, because oftentimes they can't pick it up and bring it home. They have to hide it somewhere. While they're at the dentist's office, for instance, they can read something. Education in school. We need to get into the schools right from the get-go. We need to start talking to our children, and then our tweens and our teens, and then our young adults. We have to work on not normalizing violence.
I'm grateful that funders in Canada, like the Social Science Humanities Research Council, are seeing this as an important topic. So they funded projects like ours, so the DIY Digital Safety Project, where we're going around doing research, talking to kids, and also creating resources. And we're working with amazing partners like MediaSmarts. So MediaSmarts is one of Canada's digital literacy charities, and they have tons of great content on things like digital literacy and how to be a good online citizen. And they're content and curriculum, you know, they send it out to schools all across Canada in English and in French. I do see some things that give me hope. And I try to focus on that when I hear news about what's happening in places like Alberta with, you know, premiers like Danielle Smith, who is really kind of, I think, going in the opposite direction. So, but this is normal. Whenever there's like a little bit movement forward, a little bit movement back, and that's normal, that's natural. We are making some changes, baby steps forward. There will be resistance. We just have to keep going.
Every single person has the power to influence not only youth, but all of the people we come in contact with every day. If we are living our lives in such a way that we are prepared at any point in time in our 24-hour day to say, hang on, have you thought about this? I heard you say something. Can you tell me more about that? Because I'm a little concerned by what you said. Or I'm worried about you. Should I be? If we all live that way, then we are agents of change and agents of influence every moment of every day when we're having conversations with folks. We have to recognize that violence, gender-based violence, is real. And it exists today. And I am encountering people almost every day, if not every day, who have either experienced violence in the past, are currently experiencing violence, or may experience violence in the future. If we're carrying that with us every day, then we could make a difference.
Recommendation V14 in the Mass Casualty Commission is called Mobilizing a Society-Wide Response. The commission recommends that, quote, all levels of government in Canada declare gender-based, intimate partner, and family violence to be an epidemic that warrants a meaningful and sustained society-wide response. Why are we still waiting? If you've heard some of your own story in this episode and feel a need to reach out for some support, please find your local shelter at thans.ca. Also, if this podcast and its message resonates with you and you want to help us in our mission, reach out to your local transition house to hear what their needs are. Each shelter has their own website that you can get directed to from thans.ca.